The following is for your ears only on air. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson, and we have newsmakers, experts, and reporters to bring you these stories.
The Obama defense, finally a major address on seesawing Libya, but criticism continues on the U.S. role and goal.
The Kennedy controversy, behind a new TV series on the former first family of American politics.
Teens and social media, a new medical report on the pros and cons for kids online, including Facebook depression.
To see or not to see, a critic's take on Hollywood's latest, on screen and off.
Poster boy, we talk with the artist who creates so many of the evocative signboards for great shows on Broadway before he ever gets to see them.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, a production of GateWave Incorporated, the nonprofit volunteer 24/7 radio reading service that brings vital information and enrichment to those with disabilities. Learn how you can benefit or help at gatewave.org. For your ears only, for the week of April 3rd, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson.
If we waited one more day, Benghazi, a city nearly the size of Charlotte, could suffer a massacre that would have reverberated across the region and stained the conscience of the world. It was not in our national interest to let that happen. I refused to let that happen. If we tried to overthrow Gaddafi by force, our coalition would splinter. We would likely have to put U.S. troops on the ground to accomplish that mission, or risk killing many civilians from the air.
This was his foreign minister. This was a key member of his government. The fact that he's decided to leave and effectively defect and give up his role, I think, speaks volumes about what is happening in that regime.
What President Obama did not say last week in his long-awaited address on Libyan intervention was that American CIA operatives already were on the ground with whatever footwear they favor, and that some key American air assets were about to be withdrawn. What British Prime Minister David Cameron did not mention was that the apparent defection of Moussa Koussa and similar desertion of former Foreign Minister Ali Abdusalam el-Trekki had not kept Gaddafi's forces from rolling the rebels back from several key towns they had taken. And major questions remained about what the real goal of Allied military operations would be under new NATO control and whether there were the resources and will to achieve it.
While the Libyan situation continued to seesaw, Syria saw more pro-democracy protests that left at least 10 dead. And mass demonstrations continued in Yemen, Egypt, and Bahrain. To analyze the president's speech and policies on Libya and the roiling Middle East, for your ears only, we're joined again by former Assistant Secretary of Defense Lawrence Korb, now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Welcome back to our show.
Nice to be with you again.
First, what did you think of Obama's speech, given the prior criticism he had gotten for delaying action on Libya or taking it without formal congressional approval?
Well, I thought his speech captured all of the major issues because he talked about the fact that, you know, the criticisms he's getting from both sides that he did too much, he did too little, he waited too long, talked about why, you know, why he did all of those things. I think he should have consulted more with Congress. I think that was the one big failing. I guess he did kind of have a quick pro forma thing, but the fact of the matter is once he had decided after the UN resolution was passed that, you know, we were going to take military action, he should have had a little bit more formal. I mean, you didn't have time for a vote, but I think he should have had a longer meeting and allowed, you know, explain what he was doing, allowed them to voice their concerns.
He didn't say too much about how little we know of the rebel forces and the fears they are or could become Islamic extremists like the anti-Soviet Mujahideen rebels we supported in Afghanistan who became al-Qaeda. What do you think about the question of supplying arms to them?
Well, I think now that you're in, I mean, this no-fly zone was a euphemism. I mean, basically, it's a no-fly, no-drive zone. I mean, we're using air and naval power to support the rebels. And I think under the UN resolution, the fact that you have all necessary means except occupation forces, you can and should do that, because if you don't, you're not going to prevent them from being killed.
And what should we expect from the current CIA presence with Libyan rebels?
Well, I think what the CIA can tell us is, you know, who are these people? And that obviously is one of the concerns. Who's the leadership? How did they get formed? And I think being on the ground there, they can give us a pretty good idea of what's happening. You know, the CIA was involved in Afghanistan, and the problem wasn't the Mujahideen. Basically, it was that we left after we ignored it, and then the Taliban were able to overthrow a lot of the, you know, Mujahideen people. So I think that when this gets resolved, the United Nations has got to give the same attention to it that it, for example, is given to the Balkans.
You talked about the need for air power to support or enable the rebels to hold ground, to take ground. What's your view of Washington's reported plan to withdraw some important ground attack planes like the A-10 Warthog, the C-130 gunship, at such a critical time?
Well, I think we had to make sure that the NATO and the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, who are flying planes, are able to execute that mission. If they can't, then I think we ought to have those, because the A-10s and the C-130s are much better than high-flying jets to, you know, deal with situations on the ground. But I think the key thing is that this shouldn't be seen as just an American effort. I mean, in, you know, having, because of what we did in Iraq, you know, the perception of us in the Arab and Muslim world is not what it should be. The other is we're broke, so I think it's important that other people pick up some of the slack here.
Has Obama won points in world opinion for measured action to prevent a massacre at Benghazi, or has he grabbed a tiger by the tail and taken on moral responsibility for the Civil War's final, perhaps ambiguous outcome?
Well, I think he's obviously done both. I think the fact that we did it has earned us points, particularly to our European allies and, you know, with the Arab League. The other is that, you know, the whole question of how does this end and, you know, how long are you willing to do it? But I think on balance, he did the right thing, because we got it going. We used our unique capabilities, which in a sense we've already paid for with our large defense expenditures, and then you can let the international community take over. And if it doesn't end well, for example, like Lebanon did back in the 80s, it won't be seen as quote-unquote an American defeat.
What's your view of reports that one of Gaddafi's sons was sent to London to negotiate? Do you see his father agreeing to leave, being forced out, or settling for half a country to rule?
Well, I think it's much more that he'll leave. It's interesting, you know, his sons were the ones that convinced him to give up the weapons of mass destruction and, you know, pay compensation for the victims of Lockerbie. And they're very young, you know, and they've got a whole life ahead of them. And I think they will put pressure on him. I may be optimistic, but I think time is on the side of the international community, because even if he holds the western part of the country, the fact of the matter is that pretty soon his financial assets are going to dry up and he's not going to be able to keep himself being resupplied. So I think at some point, you know, they'll recognize the game is up, and the challenge is going to be for the international community to find a graceful way out, given the fact that people want to bring him, as well as his foreign minister who defected this week, before the International Criminal Court.
You find it interesting that Obama has taken contradictory criticism from two veterans of the former George W. Bush administration?
I think it's amazing that anybody pays any attention to these people, given the way that they bungled Afghanistan, went into Iraq under false pretenses. Why in heaven's name the media? I mean, I see these people writing the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post. In fact, I wrote a thing in Politico basically because Richard Haass and Wolfowitz had criticized Obama. And I said, good heavens, why would we pay attention to them? And beside, their criticisms are wrong.
Well, and not only were they wrong by your point of view, but they contradict one another. So they both
Yeah. And no matter what Obama does in foreign policy or domestic policy, it's amazing the criticisms he gets. I mean, Newt Gingrich, in the beginning, when it looked like Obama wasn't going to do anything, was hitting for that. Then once he decided to do something, he said, oh, no, it wasn't our strategic interest.
And ironically, you find Obama's policy reminiscent of the tack taken by the first President Bush in the Persian Gulf War.
Absolutely. He waited 7 months after the invasion before we did anything. He went to the UN. He got over 200,000 troops from other nations. Plus, we collected so much money from those who couldn't participate, we actually made a profit on the war.
Obama indicates that his response to the situation in Libya should not be seen as a policy for intervention elsewhere. But what's the impact on U.S. image and influence of his much more passive reaction to developments in Syria, Yemen, Bahrain?
Well, I think it's not going to hurt him, because the Arab League is not demanding we get involved there, so you don't have the international community, if you will, behind us.
Former Assistant Secretary of Defense Lawrence Korb is now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress.
Quote from the news, like butter. That was a spokesman for Ivory Coast President-elect Alassane Ouattara on how his forces swept into Abidjan and towards the residence of incumbent Laurent Gbagbo, who has refused to cede power since losing the last election.
Next, a new Kennedy controversy and some thoughts on politics today, for your ears only. We're back for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Cut it or shut it. That was the cry at a small Tea Party rally urging GOP House members to demand more than a reported compromise of $33 billion in spending reductions offered by Democrats to keep the government operating for the rest of the fiscal year. Now this.
Boys, don't remember anything else I say. Remember this. It's not what you are, it's what people think you are. And with the right amount of money, you can make them think whatever you want.
Mrs. Kennedy, sometimes the image of a candidate is quite different from the reality.
He's exactly what he appears to be.
From the trailer for a controversial 8-part docudrama called The Kennedys that begins this weekend on the Reels channel. Packed with political shenanigans, sex and drugs, at least mega pharmaceuticals, it was produced and ultimately rejected by the better-known History Channel, reportedly after advanced criticism from the Kennedy clan and some historians. So should it be watched for the docu or the drama? Or not at all?
To answer those questions and others on more current political events, for your ears only, we're joined again by syndicated columnist Richard Reeves, also a senior lecturer at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC. His many presidential studies include Portrait of Camelot, new from Abrams Books, President Kennedy, Profile of Power from Simon & Schuster, and President Nixon, Alone in the White House, also from Simon & Schuster. Welcome back to our program.
I'm glad to be here.
You've not only seen the series, but are credited in it. What was your connection?
Well, I had no connection. I mean, apparently the credit is that the producers said that they used my book as a source, which is fine, but they picked the wrong parts.
Well, how accurate is it generally? And as a historian, what did you find most troubling, exaggeration, invention, or omission?
It's a great question. I think there was no real exaggeration, but I think invention and omission. I would say about half of it is one-on-one conversations made up, totally made up, since no one but the principals were there, and the principals are long dead. What if people are familiar with docudrama now and comfortable with it? I think that's probably fine. But if, as far as history is concerned, these were people who had a choice between, I'm making this choice up, I don't know how they did it, between the Berlin Wall and Frank Sinatra, and they chose Frank Sinatra. It's not wildly inaccurate. It's just omitted. The history is omitted. The best parts of the damn show are the black and white shots, which they use in the Bay of Pigs and the and civil rights and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Hopefully, if young people see this, they'll understand these things, particularly the civil rights parts, actually happened.
What did you think of the acting, the portrayals of such iconic figures as JFK, Bobby, and Jackie Kennedy?
I was really disappointed. You know, I mean, John Kennedy was magic, and any president is. And he was electric. I mean, he walked into a world like you'd walk into a Bruegel painting, and suddenly everybody is moving.
I remember and he could walk into the bottom floor of a townhouse, and up on the third floor, you'd feel it within seconds.
Yeah, I know. It was like physical. And it was also true of Ronald Reagan. There are presidents who are that way, and yet they play him as if he were like Hamlet. Or it actually would be a better portrayal, perhaps, of Obama. I mean, that, you know, thoughtfulness or indecision, depending on your view. John Kennedy wasn't like that. He wasn't that. In this series, he's this low-key figure. Who's popping pills and listening rather than controlling the situation, which in real life he did.
What was your reaction to reports of Kennedy pressure on the History Channel to block the project?
I only know what I read in the papers. I'm sure that there was informal pressure, but the two great pressers, and believe me, I felt the pressure from them more than once, are gone now, Arthur Schlesinger and Ted Sorensen. And so I don't know who's handling that. Steve Smith, too, in his time. I'm sure that there are lawyers who are calling lawyers at the History Channel, but if I were running the History Channel, I would have turned it down. It's not very good.
There was another chapter in presidential scandal last week with the opening of a Watergate gallery at the Nixon Presidential Library, so candid that board members didn't attend. What's your view of how that controversy played out?
Well, I haven't seen the new exhibit, but I know that Tim Natfili is a terrific historian, so I'm sure it's good. I had spent weeks there when I was writing about Nixon, and the place was kind of an empty joke. They had no archives, and the exhibits were, made you think it was like Oz or something. So that I'm kind of happy that that's happened, and I can also understand why old friends of Nixon are unhappy. Apparently it's pretty tough stuff, but we were there. Watergate was a pretty tough thing, and the truth of the matter is that whatever else you think of Richard Nixon, the man did mount a coup against his own government.
Let's turn to current presidential policy and politics. Now, what's your view of President Obama's recent speech and actions on Libya?
I thought the speech was great. I think he's a great speech maker. And I think it was designed to buy time. It was put in the best light it could, in a very modern light, that is, can we stand to turn on the television every night and see people being slaughtered, or on our computers or on our phones, for that matter? So I think the speech served its purpose, but that, of course, there are real bumpy roads ahead, both in Libya and, if it comes to that, Syria.
What about the surprising absence of formally announced Republican presidential opponents to Obama? The Republican field is pretty bare.
The Republicans covered is pretty bare indeed. I don't even see any speculation on who will be the Republican nominee. The party is in disarray. It's got a passionate far right wing core, and it doesn't seem to know how to deal with it. So they're going to have some rough days ahead. But as to who they will pick in the end, if you had to bet money, I suppose you'd bet on Romney, because he's going to have the money to run.
And the influence of the Sarah Palin and the Michelle Bachmans?
Well, I think Michelle Bachman is a kook, and that. Every time she opens her mouth, she gets the history of the United States wrong. And Sarah Palin, who's a more attractive personality, I think is more likely to be the next Oprah than the next president.
Syndicated columnist Richard Reeves is also a senior lecturer at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC. His many presidential studies do include the new Portrait of Camelot from Abrams Books, President Kennedy Profile of Power from Simon & Schuster, and President Nixon Alone in the White House, also from Simon & Schuster.
Next, teens online and at risk, for your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson.
We don't know what it can be. We don't know what it will be. We know that it is cool. This is our thing.
You made Facebook.
From Hollywood's box office hit, The Social Network. And if the real-life creators of Facebook could not fully understand what it might mean for their college cohort, they were even less conscious of the potential impact on younger kids, wannabe tweens, and teens. A report released last week by the American Academy of Pediatrics notes both positive and negative effects, from easier social interaction, long-distance education, and community participation to the risk of real-world distraction, cyberbullying, and online rejection that can contribute to a new syndrome called Facebook depression.
Dr. Gwen O'Keefe, known as Dr. Gwen on the Pediatrics Now website she created, is author of the book Cyber Safe and co-author of that AAP AFP report, The Impact of Social Media Use on Children, Adolescents, and Their Families. And she joins us now to talk about it for Your Ears Only. Welcome to our program.
Well, thanks for having me on.
First, give us an idea of how many kids are online, for how long, and in what different ways. Facebook, instant messaging, texting, potentially pornographic sexting, sending pictures of nudes, and intimate activity.
So we're talking millions and millions and millions. For the younger kids, the 2 to 11, we're talking really almost the amount of adult users for the Internet. About 16 million kids are online in that group, at least according to the most recent Nielsen estimates. That's about 9.5% of that population, which is staggering considering how young they are. For the teenagers, about 93% of teenagers are on, and that's in the 12 to 17-year-old age group. And about 20% of those kids are mobile, so they have cell phones. So that's a huge amount of kids worldwide.
Now, was this AAP report commissioned because pediatricians simply have become aware of all this activity, or are they seeing an increase in physical and mental health problems related to it?
In this case, we determined that there was a need for better guidance in social media because, as I just mentioned, so many kids are using it in all ages that we really thought with this many kids online and so much of it being social media, we needed to provide some guidance. There's already been some staggering headlines about kids committing suicide because of cyberbullying and sexting. Parents were unsure how to guide their children. Parents were struggling with their own technology issues. So it was time to really give people some guidance, pediatricians, and say, hey, this is what the landscape is. This is how you talk to people. This is why it's a health problem.
One problem is simply all the time involved and how it can distract from schoolwork, exercise, sleep, interaction with peers in the real world. Is there a reasonable time limit parents can put on social media activity at different age levels?
Well, when we talk about online, just screen time, we quote 2 hours of screen time a day for all age groups. And we do feel that that is a good amount of screen time, even for computer use and cell phone use in the mix. However, that really is focused on more entertainment use. When we talk about, you know, use for emergencies, for example, when it comes to cell phones or academic use, for teenagers, that time is going to be expanded a little bit. But I do feel parents need to watch the time and make sure kids have a healthy balance between using social media and having offline activities so that they have a balanced life.
One solution to the time problem and possible inappropriate behavior is the location of the home computer to which kids have access. Talk about that.
Well, back when computers first came out, we would talk a lot about having the home computer be, you know, somewhere visible, in a family room, for example, or in a kitchen area where there was a little desk set up. That's becoming more of a problematic recommendation now that everything's on the go. We live in a 24/7 portability culture now, so kids are accessing their computers now versus via laptops or even from smartphones. So to tell families that the computer should be in a central location is really not realistic. It's better to teach kids good habits on their computers with a focus on citizenship and have parents have a culture in their family where everybody works together and with more of an open-door policy so that wherever the child is working on the computer, especially a teenager, parents and kids can have good lines of communication because not everybody lives in a home where it's going to be feasible for people to do homework around the dinner table or the breakfast area or wherever that computer is existing. Kids may be in their room.
You also say parents should go online themselves to show they know the territory, maybe even create their own Facebook page and friend their own kid. How does that work? Sounds a little intrusive.
Well, people have to remember a number of things. The first is that you're a parent to your child, you're not a friend to your child. So you have to remember that if your child is a teenager, you're still parenting that child. You're not going to be just handing over the reins now that your kid is a teenager. I've got two teenagers at home, so I can say this with some amount of certainty that just because they turn 15, 16, or 13 doesn't mean that we walk away from what they're doing in their life. So we have to keep that in mind. The second is that they might look mature, but they're still developing, and they don't understand the idiosyncrasies of the online world the way they might figure out the offline world. So I think it's reasonable to have some home use rules for how these social media sites are used. And one rule that I think is important, and it's worked fine in my house as well as the house of many other people I know, is that if you want a Facebook page, I'm your friend.
And that way you get to see whatever they put up and what they're looking at as well.
Exactly. But I think with teenagers, it's appropriate to do it in a very low-keyed way so that you're not sort of being a net nanny, but you're doing it to mentor them through something. You're doing it to help them when Facebook changes their privacy policy. You're doing it to help them develop good posting habits and to understand how to post pictures appropriately. And if you see something, you can sit down and have a somewhat reasonable conversation with them as opposed to pointing a finger and accusing them of something, because they might not necessarily understand the implications of what they posted.
Dr. Gwen O'Keefe is author of the book CyberSafe and co-author of the American Academy of Pediatrics report, The Impact of Social Media Use on Children, Adolescents, and Their Families.
Quote from the news, Google's not strong in the rearview mirror. That was tech journalist Stephen Levy in a new book that says Google did not pay sufficient early attention to the growth of competition from social media like Facebook and Twitter.
Next, To See or Not to See, our critic on Hollywood's latest for your ears only.
We've got more for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Eddie Robinson.
This kid's got a chance to do something special. Maybe even change his life.
Yes! I want to see my son!
Give him a call. You got his number.
You stay in this, okay? This is your place. This is your place. You control it. Remember?
From the new film Win Win, which did win the heart of KCBS radio entertainment reporter and film historian Jan Wall, also at janwall.com. And Jan joins us again now to talk about it and other Hollywood news for your ears only. Welcome back to our program.
Well, hi, it's great to be here. I can't say it won my heart. I mean, at least it's a movie that doesn't rip you off or dumb down. But it's certainly not as good as the other film this man made, the director called The Visitor with Richard Jenkins. It's not on that level, but it's still a movie at least worth seeing, you know, and that's something today when most movies are going for the teen boy taste.
You also had nice things to say about the new sci-fi flick Source Code. What's the premise there?
Well, boy, it's hard to say. You know, from October Sky to Brokeback Mountain, Jake Gyllenhaal has the ability to anchor a movie. You know, he's got kind of a soulful sincerity. So this is a mind game thriller, Source Code. And it's once again this race against time, you know, one of those time reassignment sci-fi tales, but without the logic and brains of real sci-fi. So you just don't think about it too much. And he's a decorated helicopter pilot, and he wakes up on a commuter train. And it's one of these things that are trippy and kind of fun and visual. And you just go with it, and it'll be forgotten about in about a month. Until it comes out to DVD, and then it'll be forgotten about in about 2 years.
What are some of your other current favorites on the big screen now?
Usually the movies that people don't really talk about very much, because distribution is such a problem now for anything has any brains or taste or is interesting. So there was a great movie that's out on DVD now called Made in Dagenham, incredibly good, with Sally Hawkins and Bob Hoskins and Miranda Richardson, about real women instead of just victims or vixens, which has to be in most of the mainstream Hollywood movies you're seeing. But in terms of the big screen, there's a really good film called The Music Never Stopped. Do you guys know about this movie?
I've heard about it.
Yeah, it's written by the same guy. It's based on The Last Hippie, which was a short story by the same man that gave Oliver Sacks, who gave us Awakenings, okay? But this time it's this great character actor named J.K. Simmons, who a lot of people know as the father in Juno, or the Closer on television. Anyway, J.K. Simmons, when you see him, you know him, and he plays a guy whose son can only relate through the music of the Grateful Dead. because he's had brain damage. And so he has to get back to the music of the Grateful Dead in order to relate to his son. It's really a terrific journey, and Juliette Ormond is in it. It's great. It's called The Music Never Stopped, and it's worth your time and money.
And the other DVDs that have recently come out that you like?
Well, there's some good ones. Fair Game, The Valley Plain Story. Very well done. I wish I could mention comedies, but so often comedies, guys. David and Eddie, I love comedies, okay? I love the idea of getting out of yourself and just you know, laughing at something and having a good time. But so many of them are gross-out dumb-downs now that it's hard to find one. So that's why a lot of these seem a little serious, even though they're funny moments in Made in Dagenham. Tangled is good for the whole family. And, right now we're about to do Easter, so why not just find Jimmy Stewart and a big white rabbit in the movie Harvey, huh? Why not just go back to something that actually touched your heart and you didn't have to become a 12-year-old illiterate boy in order to find it funny?
Well, speaking of older DVDs, which do you recommend for younger viewers interested in a better sense of the late Elizabeth Taylor's screen magic?
Oh, man, I do a speech called Scandal and Mystery in Hollywood History, and Elizabeth Taylor gets a good 10 minutes of that talk. This is a woman who lived out loud. This woman marched to her own drum, led the parade, and never looked behind. Just fantastic. I love the movie she did with Richard Burton, the man she married twice, because their relationship was so combustible and had so much passion. Of course, she brought passion to everything from her early days in A Place in the Sun all the way through Maggie the Cat and all the way through. But I love Taming of the Shrew, a Zeffirelli film and the best Shakespeare ever put on film. It's called Taming of the Shrew. And then The Mirror Cracked is really a lot of fun with her friend Rock Hudson and Kim Novak and Angela Lansbury, based on an Agatha Christie mystery, The Mirror Cracked. You know what's great is so many of these classic movies on DVD, they just get better as time goes by.
Jen, I know that song from...
That's right. There we go. You must remember this. I mean, it's so great, you know, and we just lost Farley Granger. Farley Granger made my favorite Hitchcock movie of all time, and that's saying something, since Hitchcock, you know, he believed in the anticipation of the blood and guts. You didn't have to show the blood and guts.
And what was that movie?
And it was Strangers on a Train, and Farley Granger plays a superstar tennis player, and he's befriended by a psychopath, a gentleman villain that Hitchcock was so famous for, played by Robert Walker. A wonderful film, Strangers on a Train. It'll freak you out.
But going back to Taylor, what sticks most in your mind about her roles off screen, her life off screen?
Yes, good question. You know, and living in the Bay Area, it's especially meaningful. But all over the world, when everybody was running away from the idea of AIDS and HIV, you know, her friend Rock Hudson died from it, and she realized this was something a lot of people were dying from, and no one was talking about it. There was no money going into research, and everyone was running away. We even had a president who didn't know what it was and didn't want to know. And so what she did while everybody was running away, she ran toward it. She made sure she got to Washington, used her celebrity for something that matters, and she raised money and started foundations for AIDS research and changed the world. And God bless her for that. She changed, you know, she was determined to really make a difference. So I believe she was not only a really fine actress, very underrated, especially in her own mind, but she really cared about using her celebrity for something that matters. The trouble with a lot of these dumbed-down celebrities today, where they're having no talent people like Snooki or something who just got paid a lot of money to go to a college, you know, those people... Not only do they not know how to use their celebrity for anything, they don't know about anything happening outside of their own tiny worlds. Elizabeth Taylor, someone who lived large, we were lucky she... You know, we were lucky there was a Hollywood that enabled people to live like that.
Going back to her role as an actress, can you see any actresses today becoming a megastar like Taylor? And if not, why not?
Well, I don't see them working in the studio system. You know, she was the end of the studio system. And that was where you started small. You learned your craft. You didn't become a star right out of the gate. You had to learn it, you know, small. And you developed your craft. And then you eventually worked your way into being a star. And then you also learned about how to be in public, even though she, as I said, lived large, bigger than life. Today, what we're seeing with Charlie Sheen and people like that is this horrific world where people live in their egos, which stands for edging God out and replacing yourself with any sense of higher power. And so many of these people don't live outside their egos. So that's why it's hard to find the few that do use their celebrity for something that matters.
Jan Wall is KCBS radio entertainment reporter and film historian at janwall.com.
Next, the man behind so many great Broadway show posters. For your ears only.
We have more for your ears only. I'm Eddie Robinson.
And I'm David Alpern with another quote from the news. Study hard, but party harder. That was the message to Rutgers students by TV's Jersey Shore star Snooki in an address for which she was reportedly paid $32,000, $2,000 more than the Rutgers commencement speaker this year, Nobel-winning novelist Toni Morrison. Now this.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking, but now God knows anything goes. But authors, too, who once knew better words, now only use four-letter words, writing prose, anything goes.
From another revival of Cole Porter's shipboard comedy Anything Goes, on Broadway again these days, but for some of us, it's the poster of the lady in the sailor suit top and floppy hat from the 1987 revival that comes to mind. And that's only one of the scores of posters by the artist James McMullen that capture the soul and spirit of Lincoln Center theatrical productions and capture audience for them from sidewalk billboards, subway platforms, and the sides of city buses. Among the others, Ah Wilderness, A Delicate Balance, Carousel, and South Pacific.
McMullen has also done illustrations for magazines, including disco scenes for the article that inspired the movie Saturday Night Fever. And with his wife, Kate, he's also produced award-winning children's books like I Stink. It's about a garbage truck. But it's the theater posters that were celebrated last week at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts with an exhibition called McMullen Posters, Gesture as Design. It will run through June 11th. And with an inside view of it, for your ears only, we're pleased to have Jim McMullen with us now. Welcome to our program.
Thank you.
How many theater posters have you actually done to date?
70. 70.
Your work has to be long finished before the shows open. How do you get your sense of the production, the story, the scene or character that's going to capture or encapsulate it for your poster?
Well, the first thing I do, of course, is to read the script, the play script, probably at least twice. And then I speak to the director and sometimes the playwright, if it's a playwright like John Guare, so that I have a sense both of my own take on what the play means in terms of reading it, and also the particular viewpoint or approach that the director is going to take to the play. And this, of course, is really important when it's a Shakespeare play or something, and the approach may be very different from what you get from just reading the play. So that's all that I really have to work with. And I don't see the rehearsals, and of course I don't get to see the play until the opening night.
How does the concept of gesture as design shape your approach?
I've always been extremely interested in the human body and drawing the human body, and it seems like what expresses most about human life and the possibilities. And so in dealing with plays, in my mind, I'm always seeing the idea of people moving on a stage, of gesturing, of having expressions. And I decided early on that that's what I wanted to do with posters, that I wasn't going to deal with symbolic objects or kind of flattened, abstract ideas of the play. I really was interested in showing an emotional human side to the play. So that's what I've done. And the people that, of course, in the history of poster design, Toulouse-Lautrec and Ludwig Holbein have been very influential in showing me that the human, realistic human drawings against the formality of the rectangle are very beautiful.
I know you work with models at some point, but sometimes with actors from the production itself. Talk about the interaction you can get between two different artistic points of view, two different forms of art.
Well, if you're asking me what is the difference between working with models or working with actors, I can address that. When I have models, they're usually my assistants or good friends, and it gives me a level of control in terms of let's work out this gesture, let me see you do this, let me see you do that. But on the other hand, working with actors gives me usually a kind of very high level of specific emotional expression and gesture. I mean, you know, to ask Donald Sutherland to hang on to an easel because I have an idea about an easel is to get a range of physical possibilities of how you could hang on to an easel that most people couldn't really think of. It's just amazing.
How large is your finished painting compared to poster size, and how do you make sure the details and proportions will hold up under the magnification that's required?
Well, my paintings are very small. I mean, a lot of them are like 11 inches high, and then they're blown up to 84 inches high. In terms of worrying about the details, I really don't. The way that I work is very calligraphic. In other words, I'm not using lots of little strokes to create an illusion of roundness or to create any kind of light illusion. The work isn't realistic in that way. So when these strokes of mine are blown up to a large size, they're still strokes. I mean, they still look fine. And so I really don't think about that.
It's artist James McMullen. The exhibition of his work with samples of the sketching that goes into it, called McMullen Posters, Gestures as Design. It runs through June 11 at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts at Lincoln Center. But you can see pictures of the posters and last week's opening by photographer Jill Kremenz at nysocialdiary.com. And this has been For Your Ears Only.
Time for one more news quote. If they ever make another movie about True Grit, it should be about Jerry. That was former Vice President Walter Mondale at a funeral for one-time Democratic Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro, his running mate in the 1984 presidential campaign. Ferraro died of cancer at age 75.
For Your Ears Only is online anytime at iTunes News and Politics or PodcastBunker.com. But to continue, we need your tax-deductible donations or foundation grants. Please write to davideearsonly@gmail.com.
This broadcast was engineered by Chad Daly and Paul Roesk at Argo Studios with intern Michael So. I'm Eddie Robinson.
I'm David Alpern. For Your Ears Only is a production of Gatewave Incorporated, a 24/7 radio reading service bringing vital information and enrichment to those who can't see. Learn how you can benefit or help at gatewave.org.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on the show a year ago. I'm Michael So. This week last year, we considered a rising tide of violent political rhetoric and its connection to real violence. From our April 3rd, 2010 Newsweek On Air broadcast, hosted by David and Isaac Davy Aronson.
They are were planning some very specific plots, including a plot to take place in April, and we thought the time had come that we needed to arrest them and take them down.
The church is supposed to be a safe and sanctified place. I submit that a mother's womb is also supposed to be a safe and sanctified place. But George Tiller invaded the sanctuary of a mother's womb on a daily basis.
After the arrests last weekend of 9 fundamentalist militia members, U.S. Attorney Barbara McQuaid in Detroit explained why authorities felt they couldn't wait any longer to take action against the group charged with plotting to kill police officers. A few days later, Scott Roeder was sentenced to life in prison after a defiant courtroom speech in which he refused to apologize for killing Kansas abortion provider Dr. George Tiller in church last May.
The Hutari militia saw law enforcement as the foot soldiers of a socialist president preparing to submit the U.S. to an illegitimate one-world government. Roeder believed laws that permitted Dr. Tiller to perform late abortions were illegitimate. Later in the week, the anti-government Guardians of the Free Republic sent letters demanding that state governors step down within 3 days or be replaced. And talk of government illegitimacy is widespread on conservative radio among Tea Party followers and Republican Party leaders.
Indeed, some are questioning whether that rhetoric may be fanning potentially violent flames and paralyzing politics. House Republican leader John Boehner said passage of the health care bill would lead to Armageddon. In the wake of passage, former vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin urged Republicans to reload, while a map on her website used rifle crosshairs to indicate the districts of electorally vulnerable Democrats. All this as more than 10 Democratic lawmakers reported threatening phone calls, vandalism, bricks through windows, and one case of white powder that prompted an office evacuation. Newsweek contributor Ellis Coase sees all these developments as a danger not just to cops, congressmen, and government bureaucrats, but to the nation as a whole. And he joins us now. Welcome back to the show.
Delighted to be here.
Much of the focus recently has been on threats and verbal abuse directed at Democratic lawmakers, and you talked with one whose child took a threatening call. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's Congressman Alan Grayson, a first-term congressman in Florida. And he has twin five-year-olds, and the phone rang. One of the five-year-olds picked it up, hit the speaker button, and next thing the kid hears is someone's threatening to kill him if he votes for the health care bill. Well, the kid at first thought that the call was directed at him, so he runs to his mother telling him, there's someone on the phone saying they're going to kill me. But it's just an example of how extreme and over the top a lot of this crazy talk has gotten.
But you say threats to congressmen or their families is not really the most pressing issue here.
At the end of the day, I mean, the congressmen have pretty good protection. They have the Capitol Police they can go to with these complaints. I think the larger issue is that you're getting this crazy rhetoric filled with hate, filled with misinformation, that's getting let loose in the body politic, and some people, particularly those who are unbalanced, are taking it rather seriously.
In the 60s and the 70s, the violent fringe was on the left. Do you think we have to go back to the Weather Underground and the SLA to find parallels to the current violent rhetoric?
Well, I asked Congressman Barney Frank what he thought, because he was obviously one of those who was abused, verbally at least, in the wake of the health care vote. And he's openly gay, of course, and he was hit with all kinds of anti-gay epithets. And what he told me was that as bad as some of the talk was during the Clinton era, you really do have to go back to the early 60s, I'm sorry, to the late 60s and the early 70s to find anything comparable to what you're finding now. And that was the era of the Civil Liberation Army, the SDS, the Black Panthers, and others who were engaged in extreme left-wing anti-government rhetoric.
And do you see a direct link or an indirect link between Washington rhetoric and groups like the Hutari militia?
Well, there's certainly an indirect link. I mean, a lot of what they believe overlaps, and a lot of what they believe is just terribly extreme. And the Hutari militia, for instance, believes a lot of what some of the Tea Party people believe, which happens to coincide with a lot of the crazy thinking. And when I say crazy thinking, I mean thoughts that the president's going to turn the United States over to a one-world government. Accusations that he's a secret Muslim who was plotting to destroy the nation. This kind of rhetoric is routinely heard on right-wing talk media, and it goes in different directions, but certainly there's a huge overlap with what you see among the real crazies, and that I mean the people who seem to be preparing to go to war. And there's been a huge uptick in the numbers of those. A new report by the Southern Poverty Law Center says that these sort of militia groups since 2008 have increased, have more than tripled.
And there's a striking amount of misinformation accepted by a significant portion of the public, or real information disbelieved. You point to some findings of a recent Harris poll.
Yeah, there's a Harris poll which comes out, and what's most striking, I mean, you have huge numbers of people who believe all kinds of things, but what's particularly striking are the numbers of Republicans who believe, for instance, a majority, 67%, believe Obama is a socialist. You have 57% who believe he's a Muslim. You have a majority who believe he wants to turn the sovereignty of the United States over to some kind of government. You have significant numbers who believe he wasn't born in the United States. You have 45% of Republicans in this instance, and others who believe that he resents his American heritage, resents America's heritage. Again, that's close to 50%, and the most scary finding, I suppose, is that you have a large number who believe he's the Antichrist, and predictions of the Antichrist, of course, in this case, is 24% of Republicans who claim they believe he may be the Antichrist, and that, of course, coincides with these apocalyptic Christian groups who believe that they are engaged in a holy war now.
Your column asks how we ever get back to reasonable debate or any sense of national unity when one side sees the other as irredeemably evil. And you've studied how deep divisions and demonization have been dealt with in other countries. What answers do you see here?
Well, I guess the lesson from the other countries is that when things get bad enough, then the country has to put itself back together again. I mean, I spent a considerable amount of time in places like East Timor in South Africa, in Peru, and elsewhere where the countries were literally torn apart, and they came up with a process to try to put themselves back together again. Now, things have not reached that point here, and so we haven't had that reckoning, and God willing, they won't reach that point here.
Alice Coase is a Newsweek contributor and author of many books on society and race, including Bone to Pick of Forgiveness, Reconciliation, Reparation, and Revenge from Washington Square Press.
Rage, Rhetoric, and Violence from our April 3rd, 2010 Newsweek on-air broadcast. The angry battle over health care reform continues in Congress, the courts, and conservative rallies across the country. One of the congressional districts under Sarah Palin's crosshairs, of course, was that of Arizona Democrat Gabrielle Giffords. She was later targeted in a shopping center shooting that left her and a dozen others wounded, and six dead. Giffords' recovery from severe brain injury has been so dramatic that some supporters are preparing for her possible decision to run for the Senate seat being vacated by Republican John Kyle. I'm Michael So. We'll visit the archive again next week.